From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. This week on Foreign Dispatch, battles. In Darfur, it's humanitarian aid workers battling an outbreak of crime. In Afghanistan, it's an Olympic hopeful battling the odds. In Scotland, it's one man standing firm against Donald Trump. But we start in Iraq, where battles over a Baghdad neighborhood have had a ripple effect in the city. Since late last month, the Iraqi army has been enforcing a fragile peace in Sadr City. The vast Baghdad slum had been under the control of Shiite militias since the start of the Iraq War. Fighting destroyed much of Sadr City's wholesale market, the biggest in all of Iraq, and merchants there now are hoping for two things: money for their losses and access through a three-mile-long barrier that was put up to protect them.
Sadak Salim stands next to a stinking pile of ash and muck, watching his workers clear debris from the shell of his electrical parts store. The store is at one end of a street of burned and blasted buildings, once a prime location for business.
The fire destroyed about 200 stores and 20 factories. It put more than 5,000 people out of work, left more than 300 families without money to feed themselves.
This place is called Jamila Market. The name means beautiful. The devastation came from all sides: roadside bombs set by the militia fighters, airstrikes and artillery unleashed by the American and Iraqi militaries. Sadak says that as soon as things began to calm down, more than a month ago, he filed claims for compensation from both the Iraqi and American authorities. But so far, there's been no result.
They've been making statements that they have $1 million worth of aid for Sadr City. But so far, there's nothing on the ground, just promises.
Sadak was a wholesaler of electrical surge protectors, a necessity in this country where electric power is uncertain and surges can destroy TV sets and appliances. He says he sold up to 700 a day, not just to merchants from Sadr City, but from all over Baghdad. The U.S. military says that so far it has received claims for compensation for more than 550 people. But compensation isn't Sadak's only problem. His former shop now looks out at a 12-foot-high blast wall that encircles Jamila Market. The U.S. Army built it from concrete segments like gigantic jersey barriers to prevent militia fighters from filtering into the market. Essan Mezerlefta, another wholesaler, complains that the wall has only two entrances and it can take up to 4 hours for cars and trucks to get through the Iraqi Army checkpoints.
I want to rebuild my store. This wall will make it difficult to bring in construction materials, so I'll have to pay twice as much to bring them in.
Essan's store is clogged with rubble and a foul-smelling mass of burned and rotting vegetables. Workers have hardly begun to clean it up.
Even if I rebuild and bring in new goods, who will come to buy them? It will take them longer to get here and cost them more, so they'll take their business somewhere else. This wall has destroyed us.
A joint U.S. and Iraqi Army foot patrol passes by, supported by armored vehicles. First Lieutenant Devlin Winkelstein is with Charlie Company of the 1-6 Infantry Brigade. He says the military understands that while the wall protects people inside Jamila Market, it also makes it hard for goods and customers to reach them.
Well, we recognize that's an issue, and we're trying to strike a balance between security and then letting the people flow in and out. Right now, it's just focused on security, but we plan on opening up checkpoints in the wall soon.
An Iraqi lieutenant who's patrolling with Winkelstein says that in the coming days, the plan calls for opening two gates in the wall for vehicles and two more for pedestrians, with army checkpoints at each gate. Both officers say that on balance, they get far more praise than complaints from residents who say they're grateful for the increased security. For now, there is at least one clandestine way to get through the wall. There are two holes, possibly from tank rounds, blasted into the base of the barrier, and local children have found them. Muntadar Brahim claims he's 18, but he's small enough to wriggle through one of the holes. He says he was desperate to get into the market to collect empty soda cans to sell as scrap metal.
I just kept walking, and I found this hole so I can get into Jamila because the rest of it is all closed.
For now, that will have to do. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Baghdad.
Last month, a 7.9 magnitude earthquake struck China's Sichuan province, killing at least 69,000 people. Another 18,000 people are still missing. There was praise for China's initial response to the disaster, but as NPR's Rob Gifford reports, the longer, harder part of rebuilding isn't going nearly as well as many had hoped.
Walking around the site of a Red Cross sanitation plant just north of Chengdu, Red Cross representative Hossam Al-Shakawi has plenty of praise for what China has done.
The Chinese government seems to have prioritized a really comprehensive or complete shelter solutions from the onset. Public health and disease prevention have been incredible. Their teams are out there in the tens of thousands. The Chinese actually have a lot to teach the world about how to respond to this scale disaster.
Al-Shakawi admits, though, that the task is massive and there's still much to do. 5 million people, that's roughly the population of Colorado, have been made homeless by the quake. And he says there are many in the outlying areas who still need to be reached. You don't have to go far to see what he means. In the town of Wenchuan, the whole population is living in tents and cooking outside on tiny stoves. The Chinese government says 1 million tents have been distributed, but that is far short of the 3 million it says are needed. The tents are baking hot, and there is growing frustration at one issue, the lack of longer-term housing. They say they're relocating us to prefabricated housing, says one man whose name is Wang, but we don't know when and we don't know where. In the long term, the government of Wenchuan is deciding whether to rebuild the city somewhere else, away from the earthquake fault line. 55-year-old Yang Yun Su supports that idea, as do most in these camps. Yang says, meanwhile, all they can do is wait. If you come back in 3 months, she says, we'll probably still be here in these tents. On top of the basic living conditions, there are almost daily aftershocks that can damage already weakened housing and cause even more landslides on the roads of Sichuan that for the most part cling to a steep cliff face on one side and drop down to a river on the other.
Okay, well, this is how bad it's got. We've got out of the car, and I'm looking up at the escarpment above us, and there is a lot of dust flying around, and there's a lot of stones that's going to come down on the road. And our driver here is now shifting stones out of the way, and I'm just going to help him here so that we can get through.
Okay,
sure. So that we can actually get through.
Harder.
And I don't fancy getting one of these coming down on my head.
Farther north, in the town of Nanba, residents are retrieving waste metal from what used to be their homes. They're taking it to be weighed in order to earn themselves some money from the wreckage. Up here, towards Sichuan's famous Zhoujiago National Park, now empty of visitors, hundreds, possibly thousands, died in the quake, at least 170 in the elementary school alone. The builder who constructed the school is on the run. The complaint is familiar. We need houses, says local resident Yang Su Chun. There's anger at the lack of housing and at alleged local government corruption. But unlike the town of Wenchuan, people here don't want to leave. They say this has been their home for generations. And amazingly, here amidst the ruins, people seem to maintain some kind of dignity, some kind of optimism. We Chinese are very tough, you know, says one man named Yang Kun. He says he has set up a television in his tent, and he and his family are going to watch the Beijing Olympic Games from there. The fact that China is hosting the Olympics, he says, gives me encouragement as we rebuild our homes, and hopefully we'll win lots of gold medals.
Now to Sudan's embattled Darfur region, where a wave of crime is crippling efforts to care for the displaced. Carjackings, armed robberies, and the occasional murder largely have targeted aid workers. They now say they long for an easier time in the region, when all they had to worry about was war between Darfur's rebels and nomads and the Sudanese government. The roads were safer then. In humanitarian circles, war is easy. Crime is hard. NPR's Gwen Tompkins has the story.
Here are some of last week's crime stats from North Darfur. On Monday, it happened to UNICEF. On Tuesday, it happened to Doctors Without Borders. And on Wednesday, on the road outside El Fasher, it happened to a truck driver called Adam Ahmad Osman.
The people that appeared in front of us, and they are heavy types of guns used by the rebels here. And they asked me to open the door. I opened the door. They just put the weapon towards me. And they asked about the mobile phones.
And that's how 9 armed bandits hijacked a World Food Program truck. It was one of the Big Mamas, those white Mercedes flatbeds that take up so much of the road when they pass by. They carry hundreds of tons of food to more than 2 million displaced people living in camps. This is the fourth time that it's happened to Osman in just over a year. And sitting here amid a fleet of other spanking white trucks and Land Cruisers, he has every reason to believe that it will happen again.
When they stopping me, I have to talk nicely to them, and they take what they want, and at the end, they're leaving me to go.
Banditry, the scourge of any war-torn frontier, is flourishing in Darfur. Nearly every aid organization has been hit. Even Sudanese government ministries have been carjacked. This year, the World Food Program has had 76 trucks snatched, and 35 contracted drivers are still missing. And yet, when people commit crimes like this, they end up robbing themselves. Food plus truck means that the hungry eat. Food minus truck means that the hungry stay that way. And who can reason on an empty stomach? That's the sound of about half the grocery ration that Rokaya Mohammed Abdullah is used to getting. She lives in the Abu Shouk camp for displaced people in El Fasher. She and her 8 children depend on food aid, but the World Food Program has cut rations due to insecurity. In Abu Shouk, she says, people suspect that the Sudanese government may be trying to starve them out.
Some of us are saying that the government is behind that reduction of food. They said before they want to take us back to the villages, and we are not accepting that. So this is why they want to reduce the food to us.
Mohammed Ahmed Abdullah Yagoub also lives in Abu Shouk. He doesn't truck in rumors. The facts are compelling enough. Yagoub has 6 children, 2 wives, and debts. He borrowed food from relatives to feed his family last month, and he thought he'd get his regular portion of sorghum and fixins this month, but he didn't. Now Yagoub's children are asking for milk, and his other relatives want their food back.
So the stress from 2 sides, from my family and from my relatives, those I have borrowed from them.
Sooner or later, aid workers say they'll have to decide whether they can continue working in Darfur.
There has to, at some point, be a line. And, I mean, at the moment, we're not at that line, but we're pretty close.
Alan McDonald works for Oxfam, a British aid organization that has been providing clean water in Darfur since a famine here 20 years ago. Nowadays, they're trying to draw less attention to themselves. McDonald says Oxfam is not above renting old jalopies to get water equipment into rural areas, and they're not above hiring donkeys to move stuff either. An Oxfam driver was murdered in a carjacking 2 years ago, and McDonald has already survived an armed assault where he lives. He says crime is eating away at what Oxfam can accomplish here.
Most of these attacks that are happening go unpunished, which of course is a perfect incentive for others to do it. You know, they see how easy it is basically to hijack an NGO vehicle. And you know, these hijackings, they're not happening, you know, late at night. Lots of them are happening in the center of towns, right in the center of camps, in broad daylight, you know, the middle of the day.
So who are these bandits? No one, not the humanitarian groups, nor the area residents, nor the joint United Nations African Union peacekeeping force will say for sure. But most agree that the situation got bad when the rebels started subdividing, like spin-offs from a hit television show. What began as the Sudanese Liberation Army, or SLA, is now SLA Mini, SLA Wahid, SLA Free Will, and SLA Unity. And there are more, maybe 20 in all, operating in North Darfur. Government soldiers and Arab militia are also reportedly moonlighting as robbers. Knowing that something bad can happen at any time makes the long nights in Darfur even longer.
At one point, I wanted to throw in the towel myself.
That's General Martin Luther Aguai at the El Fasher Airport. He heads the United Nations African Union Joint Peacekeeping Force, called UNAMID. Even they have been carjacked while on patrol. The force is undermanned and under-equipped.
And at what point did you want to throw in the towel?
Yes, until I finished that book on Stop Worrying and Start Living. When I finished that book, I then determined that I must stay and see it through.
Do you think that could be a bestseller in Darfur?
Yes.
But last week, Aguai got some encouraging news. The UN Security Council said it would better look after UNAMID so that UNAMID can better look after Darfur.
I am positive now that the whole world is around to support us and make sure we achieve the mandate.
Mahmoud Jibril Shogar has also chosen living over worrying. And so far, so good. In 17 years on the road, and four of them driving for the World Food Program, he's never lost a truck. Here at the warehouse, porters are loading his flatbed with sacks of U.S.-grown sorghum for transport more than 150 miles north of El Fasher.
Really, I am very cautious. I think that one day will happen, but this depends on God.
And with a limber leap into the cab of his truck, Shogar is ready to go. He may just make it, or maybe not. Gwen Tompkins, NPR News, El Fasher.
Coming up, one man stands between the Donald and some environmentally sensitive land in Scotland.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. The developer, Donald Trump, has appeared before a public inquiry in Aberdeen, Scotland, over something that wouldn't seem that controversial at first glance. He wants to build a golf course in Scotland. However, he wants to do it on an environmentally sensitive stretch of Scottish coastline. The plan has pitted environmental groups and locals against regional officials. Reporter Vicky Barker has the story.
His trademark hairstyle disarranged by the Scottish winds, Donald Trump strode into the hall where the inquiry is being held like a prize fighter full of pre-match bravado. Far from despoiling Scotland's largest and wildest sand dune system, Trump told the panel that his mega golf resort would actually help preserve it.
Well, we're saving the dunes. We're stabilizing and saving the dunes. And I think I'm doing a great service. A lot of governments pay a tremendous amount of money to stabilize dunes. I'm doing it for nothing, meaning I'm spending the money myself.
The dunes are home to some of Scotland's rarest wildlife, including skylarks, kittiwakes, badgers, and otters.
Just a few folk for a Sunday walk? Oh, wow! Or maybe it's actually more like the couple of hundred walking to show the disgust and distaste this unacceptable development.
David Milne of the action group Sustainable Aberdeenshire. He's posted a series of videos on YouTube as part of a local campaign against building on this wild and windswept shore.
This is the force of nature they are trying to stop. Anyone ever hear of King Canute? He didn't succeed. Neither's this one. King Donald ain't going to succeed controlling the forces of nature.
National environmental groups have weighed in too. Ian Francis is with the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds.
The objections are based on the unnecessary destruction of a significant part of this really valuable part of our coastal heritage. It impacts on the sand dunes, the wild natural sand dunes, and it also affects the habitats, plant communities and birds which live on this site. It's a stunning place and it's pretty much unique in Northwest Europe.
Trump's project, though, has had strong backing from many locals and local officials. They believe the two golf courses, luxury hotel and 1,400 homes and condos will bring jobs and money to the area, just as work on the North Sea oil platforms is drying up. The same kind of high feelings and unproven accusations of skullduggery which dog so many big development projects have dogged this one. After the plan was narrowly defeated in the local council, the chairman who cast the deciding vote was ousted, and then the Scottish government announced it would revisit the proposal in its special inquiry.
I think it should have been thrown out. It should never have reached the table for a start.
This is the man who may yet prove Trump's nemesis, local Michael Forbes, whose ramshackle farm sits smack in the middle of Trump's site. He's already refused $700,000 he says he'll never sell.
No, I'm not very happy, but the fight goes on. We're not finished yet.
As for Donald Trump, he says he would probably have walked away from the entire project by now if his mother hadn't been from Scotland. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
Lastly, a story of Afghanistan, Taekwondo, and the Summer Olympics. A member of Afghanistan's national Taekwondo team is hoping to make history this summer by becoming the first Afghan to ever win an Olympic medal. The team doesn't have much when it comes to training facilities or money, but that's not standing in the way of hard work and dreams. NPR's Ivan Watson has this profile.
It's dawn, and the sun is starting to peek through the trees in Kabul's Sharinau Park. Among the Afghan men jogging here is a tall 23-year-old named Nisar Ahmed Badawi. He is an Afghan Taekwondo champion who hopes to make history for his country this summer at the Olympics in Beijing.
Maybe I will be the first medal history of Afghanistan, Olympic medal.
By evening, Nisar is barefoot, dripping sweat and yelling battle cries as he unleashes a series of powerful spin kicks against a padded target held by a trainer. Nisar and the Afghan National Taekwondo team train every night in this cramped gym located off a dirt road in Kabul. The exercise may sound comical, but the flying kicks these fighters deliver to each other's bodies are no joke. The team's coach is a Korean named Min Sin Hak. He calls this punishing exercise a warm-up.
They're hurting each other.
No, this is not hurt. You know, they are playing now. This is just a warm-up.
Coach Hawk speaks to his athletes in fluent Dari. He calls them the bravest people he's ever met. The Korean beams with pride when, during one sparring match, a fighter from his junior team fearlessly attacks Nisar, even though the boy is only 15 years old and barely half Nisar's height. The fighters take a break when the call to prayer echoes from a nearby mosque. Several young men kneel in front of a wall, still dressed in their sweaty helmets and pads, and begin to pray. Nisar, meanwhile, stretches by doing a split, moving with the grace of a ballet dancer. Though he's only 23, Nisar has already endured a battery of operations on his knees and hands due to many injuries in the Taekwondo ring. To get the surgery, he had to travel overseas because there are no sports doctors in Afghanistan. In fact, Nisar and his teammates have to train without many of the most basic amenities.
Yeah, there's no showers here.
There is no showers.
Is there a bathroom?
No, we don't have a bedroom.
Lack of plumbing or modern facilities did not stop Nisar from winning a silver medal at the Taekwondo World Championships last year. When he steps into the ring this August in Beijing, Nisar says once again he will be fighting for his country.
I'd like to prove for all the world that we can get the Olympic medal. I want to prove that the Afghan sports is very strong. I think they're thinking that Afghan is not this strong, but I will show them how is Afghan people.
Ivan Watson, NPR News, Kabul.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. While you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Dee Dee Skanky.